Hi, we're starting something new, which is always exciting. We're going to be beginning Sefer Yecheskel. So before I say anything further, I want to make notice that the shir is Le'ili Nishmas, Rechaleh Bas Rechaim Tzvi, as always, and it should in fact serve as a further aliyah for HaNeshama. So Sefer Yecheskel is a very unique one of the Sefer Nevuah. What makes it unique is the Sefer itself is full of mishalim, full of parables. Let's define parable. A parable is where you look at something using the words that are part of your human vocabulary to suggest something obscure or metaphysical that's hard to put into human vocabulary. So an example of what a parable would be the story of Rabbi Akiva and the fish, where he's at the seashore, he sees fish all excited, running about in the water, and he watches as the fox comes to the fish and say, "Fish, why are you running?" And the fish answer, "We're running away from the big fish." So the fox says to the fish, "Come on dry land, I'll protect you. You'll be safe from the big fish." To which they reply, "Fox, you're supposed to be the most clever of animals, but you're not. If we aren't safe in our own environment, how will we survive on dry land?" Okay, so this parable is meant to suggest that if the Jews can't live in a Torah environment, if we're not surviving under the Roman persecutions of his time, how will we survive if we assimilate? Shall we trust the fox, the Romans, to protect us? So the obvious reality is that Rabbi Akiva didn't see fish talk. He used this as an allegory to something much bigger, much less concrete. In this case, the idea of the uniqueness of the destiny of Klal Yisrael. So Sefer Yecheskel is replete with mashalim, and in fact, he himself, in many ways, is a mashal. He says this about himself in Perek Chet. He says, "And I am to you a mashal." Okay, so what's this about? Why is he giving us these very difficult prophecies at this time? And what was happening? So what was happening was that the Jews are being exiled. It's imminent. It's happening. He himself already was in exile. As you know, the exile took place in stages, with the important people being forced into leaving Eretz Yisrael first. So the real question that he was addressing is, what's our relationship to Hashem when we're in exile? Who are we in exile? What brought about the exile? Could anything be done? What will bring about redemption? How will things be at the time of redemption? These are the themes that flow through this Sefer. These themes are enormously relevant to us in our contemporary life. We don't know what it means not to be in exile. We haven't ever met anyone who isn't in exile. We haven't even read a book written in our own language, in English, written by someone who knew someone who wasn't in exile. So, exile isn't just expulsion from Eretz Yisrael. Even those of us who live in Eretz Yisrael are in exile. What does exile mean? So, in order to answer what exile means, let's quote Rambam, who tells us what exile isn't. He tells us that the difference between our contemporary state and what will happen when Mashiach comes is Shibud Malchiot Bilvad, only submission to the nations. He says this quoting the Talmud. The idea being that our submission to the nations isn't just cultural and isn't just linguistic and isn't just societal and isn't just political. It's total. We're defined through their lens. This is how we see reality. There's no exile deeper than exile hada'at, which is the exile of our inner ability to see things as they are, to be connected, to be discerning. So this is a book of prophecy addressed to us. Many of the ideas, especially in the first perek, are difficult ideas. The first perek, which is the perek that will begin today, is referred to by the sages as Maaseh Merkava, as the deed of the chariot, or the story of the chariot. The word Merkava, chariot, Okay, it's the same root as the word murkav, which means complex. What's the connection between these two concepts? Why is Masa Merkava viewed as so difficult, so concealed? The narrative of Masa Merkava is going to talk to us about Hashem's relationship to us. Most Nevuah talks about our relationship to Him, what has to change, what has to be improved, how we'll respond to what we're doing. This takes us a step above that. So Masa Merkava, like Masa Bereshit, takes us beyond what we could see, beyond what we could know. The true secrets of Masa Merkava are known only to the greatest of the great, are only revealed one person, one scholar to another. But nonetheless, it was written down. The fact that it was written down means that ordinary people, people like us, can learn something from it. So you have to hear this and hear it well. Don't think we're learning Masa Merkava, because far be it, far, far be it, for us to even begin to define it accurately. But what we are learning is what Yechezkel chose to reveal to ordinary people of Masa Merkava. Okay, so we're also going to have to contrast his visions to Yeshaya's visions, and you have to realize this before we even begin. Many of the things in the first perek of Masa Merkava are reminiscent but not identical to what Yeshaya saw. There's a critical difference, though, between Yeshaya and Yechezkel. Yeshaya was in Eretz Yisrael. That changed everything. So the simple parable, and we're starting with parable, is that Yeshaya was like a member of the court who saw the king. Yechezkel was like a villager who saw the king. So they saw the same king, but they saw the king from a completely different perspective. As it says in Kuzari, Eretz Yisrael opens the doors to our being ourselves. This famous parable that there was a man who owned a vineyard, and in order to get perfect wine, he had to see that the soil was right, the vines were ripe, the weather conditions were ripe, the rain was right, everything had to be right. The Jewish people are called Hashem's Geffen, Hashem's vineyard. In order for us to be actualized, we need the right land, we need the right ancestry. We need the Torah, which is compared to water, and we need the mitzvot, which enlighten us and are compared to the sun. The right earth is Eretz Yisrael. The kind of prophecy that anyone could experience in Eretz Yisrael is very different than what the same person could possibly experience in Chutz La'aretz. So because of this, Yechezkel's vision is closer to us than Yeshaya's vision, and we're going to see contrasts as we go along. So with all that in mind, we're going to begin. So it begins, Vayhi b'shloshim shana, b'revi b'chamisha l'chodesh, v'ani b'tocha gola al nar kavar, Niftuchu ha-shamayim, re-mar'ot Elokim. And it was in the 30th year, okay, in the 4th and the 5th day of the 4th month and the 5th day of the month, I'm in the midst of the exile, on the river Kavar. The heavens opened, and I saw a vision of God. So before we go any further, I'm going to read you the Targum, because it's going to open a lot of doors to us. So it was 30 years from what? So Targum answers us, 30 years from the time that Chilkiah, the Kohen Gadol, found a Sefer Torah in the Beis HaMikdash, Bazarta in the Azara, Tachat Ulma, Baflaglut Laila. He found it in the middle of the night. B'tama le'yana sihara b'yama Yeshaya ba'amon, melech shivta devet Yehuda. Okay, and this was at the time when Yoshiyahu ba'amon was the king coming from Yehuda. He found this scroll, and it was opened up to awesome words. The words were words of Tochacha, in which it said, "And I shall lead you and your king," quoting from Chumash Devarim, "into exile." So from that point onwards, it was very clear that things are going to change rapidly. So this actually took place in the 18th year of Yoshio's rule. And 30 years later, Yechezkel is standing at the waters of Kfar, after the prophecy was realized to at least a certain degree. What river is this? So there are various ways of questioning what river the river Kfar is, but the river may have been the Prat. So in order to understand the significance of the possibility that it was the Prat, Let's go back to the Bereshis narrative, where it says that there were four rivers that came forth from Eden. One of them was Prat. So what does that mean? So the Beforshim there point out that there don't seem to be four rivers that all have one source, that source being one place. These rivers are widely spread out. So you could answer, well, the earth's shape may have changed in the Mabul, whatever. But Malbim talks about it there, and he points out that the four rivers all reflect a stream of reality that comes forth from the highest plane, from Gan Eden, but gets further and further away from Gan Eden. So what are these? So if you look at these four rivers, three of the four are reflective of civilizations that bring Kina, Taiva, and Kavod to the rest of the world. All of these desires have their root in Gan Eden. Kina is meant to lead to holy ambition. Taiva is meant to lead to the sanctification of even the most base lust. Kavod is meant to see the significance and importance of what life could be. But where did they go? So let's look at them. So the first river was Pishon. Kepishon means the one that spread forth all over to where the gold was. Okay, so that certainly tells us something about the empire that seeks gold, that wants what others don't have. Sham hazahav tov, that's where the good gold was. Kina, competition. The second one, Kegichon, is described as being the one that goes within Africa, the noisy river. Okay, Taiva, the great noise, passion, uncontrolled desire. When you read Malbim there, you could practically hear the beating drums. Okay, finally Ashur. Okay, Hidekel, sharp, light. Ashur, Assyria, was the first empire builder. By empire builder, what I don't mean is that there were no wars before the Assyrian wars. What I mean is that they were the first wars that were fought for the sake of glory, kavod. But then there's Nahar Prat. Nahar Prat, the word Prat itself is related to the word fruitful. It's the river that flows to Eretz Yisrael, the place of holiness. But however, it also goes from Eretz Yisrael. It doesn't only go to Eretz Yisrael. It goes from there. It leads to Bavel. So this is indeed where Yechezkel was standing. He was standing at the place where the waters of Eretz Yisrael have moved and distanced and led him to Bavel. Not that he followed the stream, he was taken as an exile, but that's where he's standing. Khazari makes mention of this, that the prophecy had to take place by the water, because the land of Bavel had such impurity that the only possible place of prophecy would be by the water rather than the land itself. So this is our backdrop. Okay, let's see what happens there. The water, the windows of heaven open. Do the heavens have a window? What happened exactly? So the answer there to, like, what happened, it means that the normal firmament that we see opening when we fly, right, when you're in a plane, suddenly you're above the clouds, you see something else, has a spiritual parallel. The spiritual parallel is the invisible mechitza that makes it impossible for us who are on this side of the line to see what's on the other side of the line. On the second day of creation, Hashem separated the higher and lower waters. The higher waters are the spiritual source of all nurture. Hashem's midot is chesed. The water down here is H2O, what physically keeps us going. So the windows of the heavens opened. He was able to see the spiritual source of all things. B'chamisha l'chodesh, hi ha'shana chamishit l'galut melech Yehoyachin. More dates. Okay, so the reason why we mentioned the date that this began, the 5th of the month, is because King Yehoyachin was exiled on the 5th of Tammuz. And it was on that day that we're moving into the 50th year. So it's a day that was very important. Okay. Haya haya devar Hashem el Yechezkel ben Buzi ha-Kohen be'eretz kastim on Nahar Kvar uti alav sham yad Hashem. And it was that the word of Hashem came to Yechezkel ben Buzi, and he was a Kohen, and he was in the land of custom, on the river of Kfar, and it says, the hand of Hashem was upon him. So the question is, what does this mean? So the Targum takes the easy way out, so to speak. The Targum loves to take abstract and symbolic and bring it down to us so we can know what's going on. He translates Yad Hashem as Nevuah min Kadam Hashem, prophecy that comes before Hashem. So that answers our question, but the word Yad is often used allegorically to mean will. A person expresses their will through their hand. So what's happening here is that Hashem is coming to him because he wants to reveal his true will to Yechezkel. Now at such tragic times, it's especially important for him to know, what does Hashem want? What does he want of us in exile? And the main message that we see beginning in this pasuk is what Hashem wanted Yechezkel to know is, the Shekhinah is still with you. I'm here. Okay. And therefore, the significance of Hashem speaking to them is for him to console all of the other people who are already in exile or who will soon be going into exile with the realization that Hashem hasn't abandoned them. So, Rashi points out, She'en ha'shchina shoha al nevi b'chutz la'aretz, eli al yidei she'sharta alav techila ba'aretz. Tells us a klal, that the reason why the Shekhinah could be experienced by Yechezkel is because he had experienced the Shekhinah before in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, and later we find in Perek Yud Bet, and remember there isn't necessarily time order, where he says, Ben Adam al Modad al Rag Lecha, and Mechiltot says that's the beginning of his prophecy when he was still in Eretz Yisrael. So what that means is that it isn't only that the land is different and that it touches something in us that lets us grow, but a person in Eretz Yisrael is different. So this has enormous implications for us practically. Yechezkel ben Buzi, the prophet of exile, he was able to experience prophecy because he had once been in Eretz Yisrael. I've been reading in the popular press articles that have been written recently about the pros and cons of sending one's children to learn in seminary or in yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. And the basic argument against it is, well, there's not enough supervision, and in any case, there are plenty of good yeshivas and seminaries in America, and it costs money, so why do it? And these arguments are not ridiculous arguments. Truth be told, in the very large yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael, there's, by the nature of things, not a great deal of supervision. In some of the seminaries, there's also not enough supervision, although the seminaries, by and large, do a much better job of supervising, as they should, than yeshivas, since, after all, girls are girls and boys are boys. But And there are tragic stories in Maledaber. But nonetheless, for anyone to take on themselves to say that somebody could be the same person, whether or not they were in Eretz Yisrael, is enormous achrayus. How could someone say that? The air of Eretz Yisrael, the hashpah of Eretz Yisrael, is something that could touch a person for their entire lifetime. They're not going to be the same person. And of course, again, there are nisyonos here like there are nisyonos elsewhere, and possibly because of the lack of supervision in some yeshivas and in some seminaries, even more nisyonos. So certainly parents should know their child well enough to think deeply about how strong their emunah is, how strong their yirat shemayim is before they send them to a place where there's little supervision. But there are a lot of places in Eretz Yisrael where that's not an issue. And the decision against it is a decision that affects anyone. Even Yechezkel ben Buzi couldn't have prophesied on this level, certainly not, had he never first been in Eretz Yisrael and prophesied there. Ke ve'eva, v'inei se'ara ba min ha'tzafan. And I saw, and there's a storm coming from the north, Anan gadol, a great cloud, ve'esh, and fire, mitlakachat, that's burning, v'noga, and iridescent slow. It has iridescent radiance around it, saviv, around it, u'mitocha, kein chashmal, and inside, there's something that we're going to call for our purposes, great light, mitocha esh, in the midst of the fire. So what did he see when the heavens opened? What did he see? So the first thing he saw was he saw that the exile is real. There is a storm coming from the north. North of Eretz Yisrael was Bavel. He saw that the storm that had already taken him to Bavel was not one that was going to readily abate. And indeed the rest of the Jews did relatively soon, they ended up in Bavel, victimized by this storm. And the storm is described as having components of anan ve'esh, okay, of storm, of cloud, of fire. This all is meant to suggest destruction, corruption. And around all of this, there's light that's iridescent, that doesn't burn. So what he saw, first of all, was that even in the midst of the horrific destruction, that there's kindness, that there's beauty, that this is taking us someplace that we have to go. And in the midst of this iridescence, he saw the chashmal. Now, what's the chashmal? So let's start with being simple and say that it's a symbol. It's a symbol of the angels who are called Machane Shechina, the encampment of the Divine Presence. Why are they called chashmal? So the word chashmal is a combination of two words, chash, silent, mal, speak. They were silent before the awesomeness of Hashem, and then they spoke praise. So the more they would see, the more silent they would be, and when the Shekhinah would depart, they would praise. Arguably, one of the great arguments against using Ivrit as one's spoken language is that the degradation of words like chashmal, which in modern Hebrew, as most of you know, means electricity, wasn't accidental. When Ben Yehuda and others of his time, primarily Ben Yehuda, only very secondarily others, developed the Hebrew language and made it a language that you could use in modern speech, there was a distinct and purposeful plan to defile, to take ideas that people, before Ben Yehuda, people would see the word chashmal, they'd feel like getting up and washing their hands. He wanted to bring it down to what he saw Eretz Yisrael becoming, a state like all states, a people like all people. He wanted normalizations. And it's a great tragedy that to a large degree he achieved it. So we have to be able to shake off the secularization of the word Chashmal and see it for what it is. He saw in the midst of all of this the Machane Shechina. And he sees that in the middle of all of this, in the middle of all of the storm and tragedy and difficulty, that there's Rachamim. So Eliyahu also saw something similar. He also saw Merkava. Okay, and he also saw storm and fire and noise. And after that, he heard what he referred to as the Kol Dmama Daka, the still small voice. It's very reminiscent of that. What he heard through his ears is like what Yechezkel saw with his eyes. It was the Machane Shechina. Okay, so remember we said there's chash and mal, there's silence and speaking. That's the idea of kol dmama, a voice that's silent. So that means that there's a combination of speech and silence that has to be understood if we want to know what's above the heavens. We have to be able to praise Hashem with awe, with silence, and with speech, with praise. Okay, now let's look at these phrases. These four phrases, the storm, the fire, the noise, okay, the cloud rather, these parallel, together with the Noga, parallel what we call the four klipot. So what are they? So our classical example, our vehicle of parable today, right now, is a walnut. A walnut, as you know, there's a minhag that eat walnuts on Rosh Hashanah because of this, that it's gematria chet. It's brought in Shulchan Aruch, in fact. So? Why of all fruits should, you know? So the idea is that it has three shells that are bitter and hard. And then there's one that's soft, and it's attached to the nut itself. And it has the reason why it's sort of partly fruit, partly shell, partly good, partly. So, this part, this kind of shell, spiritually is called Klipat Noga. Okay, so what actually did he see? Okay, so he saw the three foundations, wind, water, fire, which parallel the three Klipot Meot, the three irredeemable challenges that Hashem created when he made the world that are there for us to reject. Kina, Taiva, Kavod, possibilities. There are various ways of looking at what they are. But what's certain is that the fourth one, the Noga, is the one that reflects the Etz Hadaat Tov V'Ra, that it has elements of good and bad, like ordinary experience, like choosing a shirt. Do I want blue or do I want pink? Where it is what you make it. So that's what he saw. The heavens open. He sees the storm, he sees the ongoing exile, the tragedy that's coming from heaven. Take note of this. From heaven. And if there, the evil is there, and it's covered by the klipot, which of course began with us. This is what drew down this sort of response from the heavens. What's the importance of saying that this is from the heavens? So if you look at the way we respond to the tragedy of exile, although we know it's from Hashem, because we read Torah, and we've read Parshas Bechukotai, and we've read the Tochach and Dvarim, but we tend to say, well, you know, Obama is, and you know, and if only Netanyahu would, and furthermore, it all began with, and it's going, and we politicize it. It's important for us to realize that what we're describing when we talk about today's politicians are descriptions of sticks that are being held by the hand of the master. This is where it begins, and